We talked about emotional health and mental health, just sketched them, really. You may have heard this week, for the first time in Barna's history, the number's over 50%. 53% of pastors want to leave the ministry. So I'm sure no one in this room. In COVID, it was 42. For pastors under 50, it was 47, according to the New York Times. But now, 2025, 53%. And a lot of things are driving that, of course. We could talk about loneliness and isolation. The stat that just kills me from the Fuller Seminary, over half of pastors' wives surveyed said the most destructive event that has occurred in their marriage was the day their husband entered the ministry. Now, I don't know if my wife would put it that way, but we did see a sign in one of those novelty shops recently, and the sign read, "We've been through a lot, and most of it was your fault." And the fact that we could laugh about that is a sign of mental health and how far God's brought us. But I wonder if you have friends whose wives no longer attend the church, their husband pastors, and maybe some of those are you. I know by the end of our ordeals, though my wife is my number one cheerleader and loves Jesus and loves the church Catholic, she found it hard to worship in our community that she once loved. You know, where's the next hit going to come from? We could talk about stress and the long-term effects of carrying stress. We could talk about anxiety in ministry and the long-term effects of carrying anxiety. According to the Fuller Institute, around 70% of pastors report that they constantly fight depression. Maybe that number's high, but what hits me in that is they report. And I wouldn't have reported it. I'm like, I'm in the 30, and I was in worse shape than the 70. We could talk about the pain of betrayals and misunderstandings and feeling deeply misunderstood. As I mentioned in our last talk, nobody reads the Psalms like the brokenhearted pastor. And once that's you, you notice how many Psalms are written from the perspective of a leader who's under attack. I mean, I've read the Psalms a lot, and I just had never noticed that before until I started reading Psalm 55, and it hit me in a new way. It is not an enemy who taunts me, then I could bear it. It's not an adversary who deals insolently with me, then I could hide. But it is you, my companion, my friend. We used to hold sweet converse together within God's house where we walked in fellowship. Oh, and I know Psalm 55. How about the balance, the both and of Psalm 69? More in number than the hairs of my head are those who hate me without cause. Mighty are those who would destroy me and those who attack me with lies. What I did not steal, must I now restore? O God, thou knowest my folly. The wrongs I have done are not hidden from thee. And we hear that anguish, that he knows he's not an innocent man. You hear that? He said, thou knowest my folly. The wrongs I have done are not hidden. And at the same time, he feels this is so unfair. And this is so not right. And it took me a great deal of therapy to say this next line. Two things can be true. I know that's self-evident to you guys. You're like, two things can be true. No, no, no. Two things can be true. More in number than the hairs of my head. My sins are ever before me. And this feels so unfair. And this feels so unjust. My friend John Ortberg talks about the fellowship of the withered hand, a reference to the palsied man in Mark 3, whom our Lord enjoined, stretch out your hand. And John likes to say, any admission of personal weakness is an achievement to be celebrated. I like Sam Alberry and Ray Ortland call this a gospel culture. But that's one of the pain points, isn't it? Because this culture of painstaking honesty and life together so that we might find healing in Christ together and pronounce over one another no condemnation. We can pronounce that over one another, no condemnation. We long to experience this kind of freedom and life together. And yet, as one of my mentors put it, in the church, we seldom forget that we are Christians, but we often forget that we are humans. And as a pastor, do you feel permission to be human? When your humanity shows up, how do people around you respond? I mean, here's an irony that is seldom talked about. Sometimes the hurt is greatest where the respect has been highest. The higher the pedestal, the deeper the resentment. Every generation likes to claim it's never been like this, but you could make a case it's never been more difficult to be a leader in this moment in the American church. The spate of people leaving the ministry and the dwindling number of people going into it bear that out. Over a decade ago, when they came out with their study on resilience and ministry, the Lilly Foundation spotlighted a new area, one they had not anticipated, that was affecting resilience and ministry. And that was the challenges of leadership and management. Nobody ever had the thought, you know, I'm really good at managing people. I'm really good at disappointing people for the sake of their personal development. I should be a pastor. No one has ever uttered that line. The challenges of leading and managing, of stewarding power in a culture acutely sensitive to power dynamics. Some of this is needed. Some of this is a long overdue correction. But like any pendulum, right now we're just living in the midst of an overcorrection. And it's left certain types of leaders, I'll just say people like me, who already were entwined in our mixed motives about pursuing excellence. It's just left us sort of halting and unsteady and anxious. You mesh that with a culture that is awash in emotional reasoning in an unprecedented way. If I feel this way, it must be true. What Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff famously called the coddling of the American mind. That book is becoming more prophetic by the day. I'll tell you how it looks in the local church. Something happens. There's an activating event. Intentions are assumed. Motives are assigned. Feelings are attached to that story that was made up. But there's no one to help all sides work through that conflict. There's no one to help all sides take responsibility for our feelings. That's the coddling culture. And when that coddling culture collides with what Tim Keller in one of his last essays calls the fading of forgiveness, what do you have? You have what we're seeing all around us. You have churches everywhere mired in intractable conflict. We have the most resources for dealing with conflict of any group in the world because we have the gospel, and yet we're mired in it. Justice and speaking truth become the purported motives for every manifestation of what amounts to be unforgiveness. And you can put all the nuances around that you want, but as the veteran peacemaker Ken Sandy once wrote, I've yet to see a case where the wisdom of Jesus needs an asterisk. For all these challenges and more, it is a hard time to be a leader. But I want to focus our attention on one particular challenge that is amplified in traditions like the one in which I was trained that place a premium on doctrine and theology and right thinking. And there is much good in that for which I'm grateful. But I, for one, spent the first half of my ministry living out of my head. Disconnected from my heart. My words and my intellect, these were my defenses. And here's the kicker, I was not aware. I was not aware of how disconnected I had become. There were some signs. I can look back and say there were some signs. I had difficulty accessing my emotions, particularly the so-called darker emotions, with any degree of depth or any degree of specificity. Much less being able to pray my emotions and pour out my heart before God like the Psalms that I preach from. Could not do that. I was restless. I was chronically busy. I was scheduled to the hilt. I was irritable when interrupted. I mean, solitude and silence felt like indulgences. These felt like early church dalliances instead of necessary weekly rhythms. And I didn't know how to rest. I would get sick on vacation because my body was so habituated to stress that when I didn't have anything to be stressed about, then I would get sick. I avoided hard conversations. I needed to be admired, and I spiritualized away conflict. As I mentioned, I was depressed, and I didn't know it. I was terrified of vulnerability, and I sure didn't know that either, because I was mighty disclosing. And I hate to be a cliche, but my work had become using God to run from God. My private prayer life could have told me all I feared to know. My preaching declared one thing, but my little heart remained hell-bent on justifying my life based on external markers, principally, how was our little church doing? Needing the approval of men. Oh, and it felt so good. Needing the approval of others. That was, and that is, my kryptonite. Now, I could name it. I could preach about it. I knew, part of me knew that these plaudits would not deliver. I knew that. But the emotional satisfaction of that drug, it just hooked my heart. And that is the nature of an addiction. You know it doesn't work. You know it's hurting you, but you keep picking it up. And I want to tell you, addicted to success, addicted to people-pleasing, addicted to stress, those are real things. And as long as I keep turning to the approval of men to assure my little heart, any hit, as good as it feels in the moment, and I want to tell you it feels good, is just going to leave me afterwards longing for more and again and a more. You know, just tell me I'm a good boy. Tell me I've done a good job. And as long as your heart needs that to be okay, you can never get enough of it. No external success is going to deliver you. You will never get off that treadmill of misery. Gerald May put it, to be alive is to be addicted, and to be alive and addicted is to stand in need of grace. Now, we could nuance that. If that word is hitting your ear wrong, you can just say, my heart is hooked in things that are not delivering my heart, okay? And truth was, I didn't know myself. You know, I thought I was a pretty smart guy, like Tommy Lee Jones says in The Fugitive. He says, you know, we're smart. Remember that saying? He said, you won't catch Richard. He's too smart. And they said, we're smart. Thought I was a pretty smart guy. And it took playing chess with a grandmaster to say, you don't know what you're talking about. You just are using these words, and you do not know what you're talking about. And he was right. It's one of the widespread but unspoken paradoxes in corporate America that executive leaders in business often don't know themselves very well. Even though there's a whole lot of energy in corporate America around feedback and knowing yourself well, and often the higher up you go in the organization, the level of self-awareness declines, right? This is known. But the same dynamic happens among church leaders. And I want to suggest it's greater among church leaders because there is something endemic to the pastoral profession that corporate executives don't face that makes self-deception an even bigger problem for us. And I believe it's the greatest challenge we face in ministry. And it's the gradual cutting ourselves off from the cries of our own hearts. You cauterize your own heart, and here's how it happens. You are earnest. You are dutiful. You got into this because you believe nothing in life is more important and more transformative than the gospel. I mean, you believe the steadfast love of the Lord is better than life. You believe that. And you want to be, as a preacher or pastor, the most effective communicator that you can be. Though personality is inescapable in preaching, you don't want your own experience to be the spiritual summit to which you summon others. You want to faithfully exposit the promises of Scripture, all of them. and to preach the gospel clearly as I ought, Paul writes, and boldly. So what happens? What happens when you hit a dry spell? As inevitably we do. Seasons. When the promises you are preaching are ringing hollow in your own heart. Well, I mean, you can't just keep taking a sabbatical. You just keep doing your job week after week. You keep speaking passionately and with deep conviction of the matchless treasures knowing Christ. But something's happening to you. Your heart is not experiencing what you hear your mouth declaring. And slowly something begins to happen to your heart. It's disconnected. You are living a bifurcated life. The cauterized heart. So this is more subtle than hypocrisy. It's precisely because you don't want to be a hypocrite. It's precisely because we don't want to be hypocrites. And so how do you deal with this? You preach the gospel to yourself, but over time you can begin to feel like an imposter, or at least a poser. Remember the line from No Country for Old Men? You've been putting up your whole life. You've been putting it up. You are preparing a face to meet the faces that you meet. And before you know it, you just put on that pastoral persona. And it is exhausting. Now, as we said in our first talk, this not being in touch with emotions is a challenge for any man in modern Western culture with our distorted notions of masculinity. I learned this from reading the Iliad out loud to my kids before bed and just realizing, man, these guys were, they're killing each other with javelins in one line, and then they're embracing and weeping with one another the next line. I'm like, I don't have either one of those. Deeply in touch with their emotional life. Most of us grew up in homes where we were trained to deny our emotions. And unless you had a remarkably emotionally sensitive father, who had a remarkably emotionally sensitive father himself, you should not expect that this would come easily for you. The impulse to deny our emotions gets amplified in a church context already suspicious of enthroning emotion. And when that gets bolstered by a learning environment heavily influenced by the Enlightenment, you see what's happening? There's pressure from all directions conspiring us to live heady lives. I mean, you live in the epicenter of that, I might suggest. I suspect more than a few of you know this gap of which I speak between what you profess and what your heart is experiencing. And you live with that gap, that pain, long enough, it might come out in some form of addiction to compensate or to fix or to soothe. It might come out in some life-altering, unforeseen act of self-sabotage because a part of you is just so tired and can no longer manage that you just blow your life up. We know those stories. But I'm suggesting far more widespread and therefore far more damaging to most pastors is this gradual cauterization of the heart. And I believe it comes out in a lack of mercy, in a lack of mercy and compassion that we show one another. You know, I have always wanted to be and aspired to be a preacher of grace. But I had to admit, you know, when I was in the crucible, that when I was squeezed, that was not what was coming out of my heart. That was maybe ninth or tenth on the list coming out of my heart, was grace. Meanwhile, you stand up week after week and you proclaim the power of the gospel of grace, Acts calls it, to set us free from the penalty and power of sin. And we hear ourselves saying, let not your hearts be troubled. Fret not. Be anxious for nothing. But we are fretters. And we are anxious. And this is a real occupational hazard. Habitually declaring with our mouths that are not resounding with what Edwards called our affections. Again, more than our emotions, but they are not less than our emotions. And it's because you don't want to be a hypocrite, this gap begins to weigh on you. So are you able to acknowledge this gap? Are you able to grieve this gap? Are you able to lament before God this gap and confess that you long for wholehearted devotion? The ability to grieve is actually your great strength. We should worry more about those who do not see their need of a physician. But when this cauterization is prolonged, you know what you get? You get burnout. That's all burnout is. You're just worn out from ginning up the joy, and as T.S. Eliot put it, preparing a face to meet the faces that you meet. Or in biblical terms, it's just ministry in the flesh. Wood, hay, and stubble. And let me tell you, you can get by for a long time like this. And let me tell you something else. This inner turmoil can actually fuel you. You know, some of you remember in high school, the Scarlet Letter, Dimmesdale's sermons got better after Hester Perrin. This turmoil can fuel you. But you are left with a dilemma. You can either guard your heart vigilantly, and as Paul puts it, enter into a life of strict training, all the while striving to rest in Christ. A life of strict training, see all the swelling interest in spiritual practices, habits of grace, sacred rhythms, cobbling together rule of life. Or, because at this point that gap, if you're honest, feels more like a chasm, you can take an extended sabbatical or intensive counseling or both. And before you know it, you just come to accept this bifurcation as status quo. At least 53% of us do. You know, your theology says Jesus meets our deepest needs, but your heart still feels that insecurity. Looking to our work to be for us what only Christ can be. I mentioned his name earlier. Tim Keller once confided, all ministers who know themselves will be fighting this all their lives. Now, someone like you who's read a lot of his books and heard a lot of his sermons, I find this to be an unusual admission, a window, I think, into how hard Tim fought privately and daily for hours against this. All their lives hits me in that line, that you never get to a point where this temptation is beyond you. Perhaps this is why he added, the ministry will make you a far better or far worse Christian than you would have been otherwise, but it will not leave you where you were. Preaching, pastoring, leading, and managing will put enormous strain and pressure on your character. Like a Mack truck on an old wooden bridge, over time the weight of ministry will expose the hidden cracks and fissures that carried you into ministry before you ever thought about becoming a pastor. Those deep unmet needs for safety, security, acceptance, and belonging. In his biography of LBJ, Robert Caro, footnote, one of the great biographies ever written, if you like biographies, Caro concluded, power doesn't always corrupt. What I believe is always true about power is power always reveals. You spend enough time in the ministry, it reveals. It reveals you like nothing else. It reveals what drove you into ministry that you thought you'd already dealt with. You're like, that's how I got here. That's behind me. But who can you talk to about this? I mean, how does the healer talk about his own need for deep, ongoing healing in a wise and responsible way? This is a good question. But I know this, the longer we preach a gospel of God's white-hot love, if that love is not continually melting and softening our own hearts, if we are not basking in the shining of God's face and approval upon us, the longer this disconnect persists, the more cauterized, the more cut off from the cries of our own heart, we will become. I said this earlier, you read the Psalms, and you think it's an easy thing to pour out your heart before God with all the emotional dexterity and granularity of an Asaph or a David? Where do you end up? You end up with what Francis Schaeffer famously called biblical orthodoxy without compassion. And so we have it. Churches and leaders of churches like I was, our hearts not experiencing, our lives not manifesting the words we are declaring. Now, Perhaps you think I'm overstating this. You say, well, this has always been an occupational hazard. I think it's a bigger problem today and explains why so many of our churches are riven with conflict, because it's not just the pastors, it's the staffs and the elders and the deacons. It's the whole complex. because our churches are not shot through with this wholehearted vision of deep discipleship. It's not just the pastors carterized. It's not just the pastors living in their heads. Some of us are suppressing emotions. Others of us are enthroning them. But we don't know how to regulate them. And we're tearing each other apart. You can't give what you don't have, and you can't get it without a deep acquaintance with mercy. Boy, I hear this word, this line very differently today. Streams of mercy never ceasing. Streams of mercy never ceasing. And my question has been, Lord, how do I live in the place where those streams of mercy are falling upon me like streams in the Negev? How do I live in that place, Lord? Well, not the only way, but one way that I want to leave you with today is to embrace vulnerability. To embrace vulnerability is a new way of life. You say that's not a biblical word, and that is true. But meekness is, gentleness is, let your gentleness be evident to all. Humility is, clothe yourselves, all of you. Learn from me, for I'm humble in heart. Only God gives the growth, by grace alone. But if these are the fruit that we want to see, gentleness, meekness, and humility, vulnerability, you could say, is the kind of fertilizer for the soil of the heart. Vulnerability is hard. Vulnerability for me was terrifying, especially for men, as Brené Brown famously pointed out, because one of our biggest shame triggers is being seen as weak, or feeling weak. And she famously argued, we've collectively bought into this myth that we are convinced deep in our bones that vulnerability is weakness and therefore to be avoided at all cost. So let me give you my definition of vulnerability. This is cobbled together from several sources. We can define vulnerability as, every word's important, the awareness of our weaknesses, limitations, and failures, and the willingness to abide, the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure of letting ourselves be seen. Every word of that definition matters. Awareness, we've already talked about this, should not be a given. We should presume that we lack it. Peter insisted vehemently, as did all the rest. We should presume that we lack this awareness. You should not expect this to come easily to you. Okay? Awareness. You should assume that you do not know yourself. Of our weaknesses, I don't know how you read 2 Corinthians 12, boast in your weaknesses. I read that aspirationally, because you can't boast in what you can't name. You are deeply in touch with your weaknesses. Limitations aren't sins, but you're becoming more and more comfortable with your limits, your deficits. You're able to say, yeah, I don't do that well. Stephen modeled that for us a few minutes ago. And failures. Every leader has a shadow side. Can you name yours with devastating specificity? The parts of yourself that if this fell into the wrong hands, I would lose my job immediately. You have that. Can you name that? Fearless moral inventory. We must become and remain deeply in touch with our own brokenness. Not a theoretical saved wretch like me, but in a grounding way, as in low to the ground. Not groveling, but no longer afraid. I like what Parker Palmer says. I learned through my depression that the ground is a safe place. You know, the ground. Aware of those core lies, what we talked about in the last talk, those patterns and scripts. David White is, as far as I know, not a follower of Jesus, but I love this line. He says, "Honesty, lies, and understanding are close and necessary relationship with not wanting to hear the truth." Honesty lies in our close and necessary relationship with not wanting to hear the truth. Man. Again, this is hard for us. If you spend your days answering the life questions of everyone coming to you, it's hard to admit, wow, I know nothing about this. I am a kindergartner. And the willingness to abide. Boy, it is hard to sit in this space, much less to live out of it. You have to be willing and able to feel the pain. And as I said, for me, that took admitting, if I let myself feel that, it is going to kill me. To abide this place, live out of this place. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Abide there. Abide the uncertainty. Almost done. If you let your guard down and let people see you, you can't guarantee that you won't get hurt. You cannot hedge against the risk. That's what the word means. Emotional exposure. You're opening yourself up. And I want to tell you, it is terrifying when it is real. Vulnerability, by definition, entails what was so hard for me, emotional exposure. I mean, how could I let others see what I wasn't in touch with myself? And what are you going to do when you see this? I mean, this is primal fear. As in Garden of Eden, fig leaf stuff. Primal. It's not overstating this to say that for me, I so associated vulnerability with fear and with weakness. I was so terrified of feeling unprotected that I had and I have a visceral distaste for it. Even I use this word cautiously, even contempt. So deep-seated was a part of me that needed to protect and to defend. Now, I had all kinds of armor. You would not have suspected this about me because I had some pretty impressive armor. Part of that armor was my pursuit of excellence, which I can now admit was really closer to perfectionism. And where perfectionism exists, shame is not too far behind. I want to say for pastors especially, vulnerability goes beyond being disclosing. And as pastors, you know what I mean. Some of the most disclosing people are the least vulnerable. I mean, it's kind of indulgent to appear vulnerable, right? All of you who are preachers know this, the indulgence of appearing vulnerable. Look how vulnerable I am. But it's the opposite of that. It's letting you in just enough so that you never get in. It's a defense mechanism. It happens every Sunday in pulpits so that no one ever gets in. As pastors, vulnerability is super challenging for us because of one gigantic fear. How is this going to be used against me? And now you see the dilemma. If the way through the bifurcated life is to move into a life of increasing vulnerability, but vulnerability is by definition perilous, then what? If that is the way out, but I, what? How do we cultivate this life of vulnerability? What is appropriate vulnerability in a leader's life? How can we pursue self-awareness in a way that sets us free from fear? These are other talks. But I want to leave you with this today. Why be vulnerable? Because here is what I know. Here's what I know in my bones. Vulnerability is the path to intimacy. It is the path to intimacy. It is the path to intimacy with your spouse, if you're married, with your children, with your friends, if you want the kind of friendships you've always wanted, and with your God, if you want the kind of prayer life where you can pour out your heart before God and roots and grounds you in the love of God. Vulnerability is the doorway to intimacy. It is the bridge from our heads to our hearts. It is the pathway to feeling fully alive. It is the pathway to feeling fully alive. And it is a signpost on the way to joy. It's the pathway to healing the bifurcated life. We keep bringing our real selves before the real God. Okay? Presence to presence. Alongside that urgent sense of our need to cultivate rhythms, yes, that's there. Training, not trying, training, continually keeping our hearts close to the gospel that we so desperately need. But what's happening? What's happening over time is a growing gentleness from a life of vulnerability. We're just practicing bringing all of ourselves into the light of God's burning love. And you're just sitting there, learning how to be still. Streams of mercy, never ceasing. And it results in what I like to envision as an undefended life. Man, that's what I want, an undefended life. And let me leave you with this. You have read these words, you have preached these words, but let's let these words wash over you from the book of Hebrews. Because it's a picture of embracing vulnerability in God's presence. Let us, you hear that? Abide, willingness. Let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance. I'm accepted. I don't have to be afraid anymore. Of faith, confidence in God's benevolence towards us. With our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. Sprinkled clean from an evil conscience. You hear that? No longer tormented, but Jesus' presence soothing and overriding that inner voice. Christ with us. And then you get up and you do it again. All your life. Vulnerability, streams of mercy. Whew. Amen.